The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly. And there's no Allegra this week. She's taking a well-earned break. But boy, is she missing some special guests. Joining me in the pod is our columnist, Julian Glover. The power behind the force that is Comment is Free, Ros Taylor. And the MP for Hackney North, Diane Abbott, who is also a contender to be the leader of the Labour Party. Good morning to you all. Well, Parliament may have risen and the Prime Minister might be out of the country, but the sharpening of steel can still be heard right around the nation. And today we're going to begin with one of the departments whose head is on the block first: Culture, Media and Sport, previously known as the Ministry of Fun and nowadays known as the Ministry of Glum. This week we learnt that the UK Film Council is to be axed and that funding for minority sports at the Olympics is also going to be squeezed. So we got our own Polly Toynbee, who when she gets away from the office has a hand in organising an arts festival, to make the case for maintaining spending on culture.
The arts in this country are a huge growth industry at a time when other industries are struggling. For every pound that's put in, it levers in £2 back from commerce and from sponsorship and from tourism. So it's very good value for money. It is an investment. It's not just a spend. The other point about it is that the Arts Council England has said it knows, of course, it has to take a hit. It's got to take a 15% hit, and it can just about manage that over 4 years. But that's a real tipping point because the arts are, you know, very, very spread, very thin already. If it has to take a cut of 25%, that is lethal. A whole lot of arts venues will vanish, disappear. Damage will be done that can never be recovered. And that's only a £46 million difference between the 15% and the 25%. So if they cut that, that is an act of vandalism that can't be about economics. It can only be about making the political gesture. Arts must take the hit along with anyone else. But that £46 million is crucial, and they're being very sensible about, well, we'll have to take the hit of 15.
Julian, you're an opera buff, but you're also someone who doesn't believe that the taxpayer should have to bankroll everything. Where do you come out on this? Should arts be chopped?
Every department can make a case for exemptions. And in the end, the only ones that are going to be exempted are the NHS and international development. And of course, we could argue we could take money off the NHS and subsidise arts. I think it is extremely unlikely that arts subsidy will continue at its current level. It's also extremely unlikely it'll be cut so much that arts in Britain will stop. The government is strongly committed to arts. People in the government go to arts venues, they go to cultural events. Ed Vasey, the culture minister, spent the last 2 years in his job winning over the arts world. What they've got to do, though, is to stop wasting money. And the starting point for everything is cuts that aren't directly subsidising venues. So we had the UK Film Council go this week. There was an immediate protest from the sort of loveys of the world. Amanda Iannucci was busy texting about it. We had lots in The Guardian about it. It was an incredibly bloated organisation. It employed 75 people. It produced huge amounts of film which were not successful and not needed. It paid its chief executives comically large salaries, and it was already being debated for abolition by the Labour Party when it was in power and moving it as part of the British Film Institute. That cut is a good cut. It should happen. Will, in the end, cuts happen that stop things that we want to happen in our country? Yes, it probably is unavoidable.
You don't see a sort of big society solution, philanthropy and all that?
Well, the government, of course, in the run-up to the election, talked to all the opposition. Now the government talked a lot about philanthropy and the idea that business would come in. Business will come in for a few elite art venues. The Royal Opera House could go to Dubai, raise huge amounts of money and make up for any cut it gets. The Royal Opera House has always been magnificent at getting cash out of the system. It manages to get a £30 million subsidy at the moment from the taxpayer, which is hardly justifiable. I do worry about what will happen outside London. There aren't big businesses that are going to come up with cash for things like the Nottingham Playhouse. Difficult.
Ros, what do you think? Doom and gloom?
Well, I share some of Polly's concerns about money being taken out of something that, as she says, does bring a lot of tourism and money into Britain. That said, money is going to have to be chopped from somewhere. And I read a very persuasive column by Daniel Trilling, who's on The New Statesman, yesterday, saying that actually the UK Film Council had been very very against innovation in making film, and it had supported things that it thought would do well commercially, as sort of almost replicas of Four Weddings and a Funeral. And it really hadn't been the force for innovation and excitement that it might have been. And I think he had a point, thinking about some of the films that have come out of Britain recently. So I'm wondering if there is certainly a case for a shake-up of the way we fund film, of the people who decide who gets money, and perhaps a case for involving philanthropists in a more engaged way. Now, there's always the problem of nepotism, but what I've been asking myself the last few days is the Arts Council and organisations like it, are they just as nepotistic as a philanthropist might be? And it will be interesting to see whether they are.
And Diane, on the streets of Hackney, do people see preserving the Royal Opera House or indeed the Nottingham Playhouse as a priority, or do they think if we're going to have cuts, we'd rather have schools protected?
They're not in floods of tears about the Royal Opera House, but the problem with cuts in the arts is that big, strong, mainstream, middling organisations will survive. But the sort of funding which has just begun to be given to minority arts, I've got a little theatre, the Arcola Theatre, my constituency. It's a great alternative venue. And for a little bit of money, you can do so much, particularly to groups that wouldn't necessarily have been seen as part of the arts mainstream. And the fear must be in Hackney and other diverse areas, it'll be last in, first out. If you were the last group of your kind to get state funding, then you'll be the first to get kicked to the curb. And the other thing to say about this is, yeah, of course you can reorganise the arts, you probably reorganise the Guardian, but the sums of money involved are relatively small. And this is being done partly because Jeremy Hunt is a clever man and an ambitious man, and he wants to be seen to be out there slashing his department. And secondly, it's kind of exemplary. You know, you could save a lot more money doing away with the Trident nuclear weapon system.
But it all adds up.
This is being done because poor Ed Vasey, as you say, he spent 2 years in doing this up to the arts community. He won't be invited to many more dinner parties by them, I suspect. But, you know, it's all kind of exemplary. It's all for show. The sums of money involved are not huge.
It's for show in a different way too, which is the reason we're talking about it now, is that Jeremy Hunt has led. Some departments have been very secretive about the cuts they may impose. Others are trying to put them into the public domain and get a debate about them. And arts is clearly doing that.
Because he's ambitious. He's trying ambitious. To prove he's a cutter.
He's also trying to get people to talk about the subject so we don't get the cuts. And we're doing exactly what they want.
Well, that's good. That's reassuring. Maybe the Arcola Theatre will get some state money.
Well, time to turn to the biggest story for The Guardian this week, which has been the massive leak of over 90,000 documents relating to the war in Afghanistan. Detailed in the mountains of files, we learnt of unreported civilian casualties, of targeted killings and so-called friendly fire incidents, many of which had previously gone unreported. If you had to try and sum up the prevailing impression you get reading this stuff, it's confusion and unpreparedness of the soldiers carrying out the missions. Now, Julian, we were once led to believe that wars could become clinical and computerised. If that needed debunking, these files have certainly done that.
Yeah, these documents are fascinating. I mean, I've got some concerns about their impact on the security of people who are named in Afghanistan, which we need to remember. They won't come as a surprise to governments. Governments have seen this stuff. It shouldn't.
It's their stuff.
It's their stuff. It won't come as a surprise to people fighting the war because, as you say, it's a complete mayhem and it's total confusion and they're losing. So they know that already because they're out there and getting attacked and taking terrible casualties. I wonder whether it comes as an immense surprise to the public either, who now think we are losing. The people it perhaps undermines the most and has done very well at are the people who've been telling us the war's going quite well, the people who are the defence community, the people, some politicians too, who must have seen evidence like this and yet have told us that this war is developing, that each year is getting better, that the strategy before was no good but now it's improved. One thing to remember though, these documents go up to 2009, they don't go into this year, and that leaves a little bit of room for defenders of the war, of which I am not one, to say, but that was before the surge. It's all different now. We've got our new strategy. No, nobody believes this. And you can see, if you look what's happening on the ground with attacks on civilians, just in the last few days, there isn't an improvement. The chaos is still there. The terrible incident with a bus being blown up in Afghanistan today. It's absolute mayhem.
But Julian,
and yet they will say this is retrospective. We've learnt the lesson.
But Julian, you're trying to say to the defence about the defence community, oh, they're trying to say the war is going well. Ill behoves me to defend the defence community, but I've never met anyone from the defence community who believes that the war in Afghanistan is going well or can be won, as the British public would understand winning.
It's not what they say in public. It's not what they say in public.
I know that's not what they say in public, Julian.
And so this
it will come as a shock to you, but
no, it won't come.
But generals and military men say different things in public than they say in private.
Of course they do. I'm perfectly aware of that, and that's what this. What the use of these? We're talking about these documents. What the use of these documents is to put to people who in public are making rather bland statements about success, and say it doesn't look like that here.
I think we should get out of Afghanistan, but. Rose,
well, I think this is this leak came at a very useful time for the government. David Cameron said a week or so ago, indicated that he would like to be out of Afghanistan by the end of this parliamentary term. And then these enormous numbers of documents came along, which, frankly, make the extracting ourselves from the country much, much easier, I think.
Good.
Now, it's a bit more difficult.
You suggested the government leak these?
Well, no, I don't think it's but it's a bit more difficult for Obama because, of course, he won an election on the strength of the surge of his determination to settle things in Afghanistan. And already, as Julian says, the American administration's reaction has been to say, well, this was all pre-surge, and that's not good enough. So I think the biggest impact will be in America. I think the British public were already tired of seeing soldiers coming home in coffins. They were already sceptical about the value of the war. This will add to the weight of opinion and will make it that bit easier for us to withdraw. But the question is still, what is America doing there? What can America achieve?
Well, Ross is right. But, I mean, it undermines particularly the last government, because we now have a government which is trying to get out of Afghanistan and trying to build a rhetoric about leaving. We didn't have that before. I wonder whether David Miliband saw some of this detail, because it was not reflected in the public statements he made.
Well, I wasn't a minister in the last government. On the question,
no, but you must have listened to what they said. I mean, do you feel
that...
You didn't believe it. Maybe do you think David Miliband was actively lying?
It's not for me to comment on that. Let me just say about America, though, and Ross said, oh, it's very difficult for Obama. Look, Joe Biden, the vice president, was emphatic they should get out of Afghanistan. There is a big split in the US administration around Afghanistan. And Obama, as it is, won't weigh up all the evidence. It kind of came down somewhere in the middle. But all the pressures in America for them to come out, it's not a war that can be won. So if anything, even though the administration is making noises about how terrible, blah, 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 it is helpful to people like Joe Biden and Obama himself, who would prefer to come out if things happen which feed the temper, the anti-Afghanistan war temper.
Just remind us, for listeners who won't remember, you were against the Afghanistan war from the beginning, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I was, because...
And what would you have done with Osama bin Laden?
Well, I mean, by the time... No, come on. I mean, the Afghanistan war at the beginning had some kind of superficial attraction. We're going to go there and find Osama bin Laden. But of course, he could have been driving a cab in New York at that time, for all we knew. I mean, certainly now. And the thing I learned actually going to Afghanistan is that the troops that went there initially felt that they were greeted as, like, you know, liberators. Now they think an army of occupation. So, no, I mean, it was kind of foreseeable. I mean, the thing about Afghanistan is the geography. There's a few countries in the world where geography is both history and politics in the same way. And you were never going to go and fight him in those caves up in the Hindu Kush.
And I think you're talking about a fairly rapid timetable for withdrawal rather than overnight withdrawal. Why is that? Are you concerned about women's rights and that kind of thing if we pulled out too quickly?
Well, I think the women's... I mean, I think there has to be some kind of military presence there. But I think it should be, but I think it should be a UN-led presence, and hopefully led by troops from Islamic nations, which have, I think, a little bit more sort of credibility with the population. And one of the things you have to do is deal with those social issues like women's rights. But the idea that we playing Robin to America's Batman can conquer an area which no Western nation has conquered for 200 years is nonsense.
OK, well, moving smoothly on to the rest of your campaign, if we can now, Diane. It strikes me that you've got policy positions which are pretty popular with the party on cuts and on the wealth gap and on the war, but you're not favourite at William Hills. And I wonder whether that isn't really because the party well remembers that when people like you were more of a force with it, it didn't tend to do so well in the country.
You seem to forget that since we came in 97 to now... we've lost millions of voters. And the reason we were able to win three general elections in a row was not because our vote continued to climb, our vote dropped, but the Tory vote didn't come out. And there's no question that the New Labour project, the presidentialism, the genuflecting to the market, that doesn't have much traction with the public. I mean, when you say people like me, people that believe that you shouldn't have a Goldman Sachs banker telling you what to do about welfare, which is what happened under the last government. People like me are pretty mainstream in the Labour movement.
Labour Party won elections when Tony Blair was in charge. It didn't win
with
them
a declining
after.
Share of with the vote.
There was many reasons why people didn't like politics. I agree. Lots of the things you're saying are popular. Lots of things you're saying are brave, and they're things that politicians should be saying. The challenge, I think, for you is to give that a coherence as a programme for government, not just a series of protests and dislikes, but a coherence. And one of the areas I think I haven't heard from any leadership candidate really is what they would do as an economic policy in place of the one we now have. They clearly don't like the one we have. What's your programme? Would you want to reduce the deficit? Do you think we don't need to worry about the deficit? Do you think we should increase taxes?
There is a deficit. To what extent it's a cyclical deficit, because you always go into deficit in a recession because you raise less money from taxation, you have to pay more money in benefits. To what extent it's a cyclical deficit, it's hard to call. But I would do three things. Currently, the government, the Tory government, is raising 80% of the money to fill the deficit from public sector cuts and only 20% from taxation. The last time we had a big cuts budget, it was Norman Lamont, and he had 50-50. What I say, 50-50 is good for Lamont, it's good for me. So I would raise...
But you opposed it at the time.
Well, you asked me what I would do, and I'll tell you. I would increase the proportion of the monies raised to fill the deficit to come from taxation, because public sector cuts are a double whammy for the people I represent. You lose your job, you lose your services, but also there's a danger. When you cut the public sector, you take demand out of the economy, and the danger is if everyone does this, and Obama and his Treasury Secretary pointed this out, if every European economy has these deflationary policies... So you take more from tax. You take more from taxation, less from public sector cuts. In terms of taxation, I would have a financial transactions tax, I would have a banking tax, and I would bring the 50% tax rate down to people earning 100,000.
What have you learned, or what have you changed your views on since the 80s? I mean, do you think the sort of what people like Tony Benn were saying in the early 80s about having an alternative economic policy where you had capital controls, you had import controls, you had strict wages policy sometimes, is that the sort of view of the... Because you complain about the market, but what's the alternative? Is it a much more planned economy?
The alternative is to regulate the market. It's no coincidence that the Spanish banks came out of the credit crunch much better than our banks for quite simple reasons. The Spanish financial regulators insisted on much higher levels of capital adequacy. Gordon and Ed Balls, in fact, were mesmerised by bankers and boasted about light-touch regulation. Now, it's not against markets, but you have to recognise what's appropriate for markets still and what isn't appropriate. And secondly, you have to regulate them appropriately, both in Britain and in America, for, in some ways, social reasons. People were enthralled by bankers.
Can I ask one very brief question before Ross comes in? You make the case that you're an outsider, you weren't part of the last regime, that Ed Balls and people got it wrong.
They were part of the old regime.
You said he was wrong on finance. That implies
on
complete,
regulation.
That implies a complete clear-out of the hierarchy of the Labour Party at the moment. So who are you going to bring in with you? Who would you be your shadow chancellor?
No. I wouldn't have a complete clear out, for one thing.
So you'd have the people who got it wrong still there?
No. I think I wouldn't have a clear out. I mean, many of the people who are currently shadow ministers are extremely talented. Generally speaking, they're people who will do what it is suggested to them to do. This is to this. They've flourished doing that. So I have no difficulty in working with the current population of the Labour Party front bench. The issue is the underlying principles. And I'll tell you something. The same people you're saying, oh, you couldn't possibly work with, they come up to me in private and say, oh, I do so agree with you. Oh, you're so brave. So it wouldn't be so hard to swing them behind a reasonably progressive policy in government.
Do you think the Milibands say that?
The Milibands... Their mum will talk to them.
In 23 years in Parliament, you've not been previously, have you, on the front bench?
No.
Maybe partly by accident, partly by design. You're now in the limelight like never before. Are you going to be looking to get into someone else's shadow cabinet in the quite likely event that someone else wins?
I've always been in the limelight. I've been done over by the tabloid press more times than anybody else, actually. I'm not looking beyond September and the close of the ballot. I'm in this to win this. I'm not speculating what happens beyond that.
Ros, as a voter, if I can just turn to you in that august capacity, does it would it worry you that someone like Diane is looking to move into the very top job in politics after a long period of representing people but not actually running things? Do you think that will be a problem with the selectorate and indeed the electorate should she win?
I think the bigger problem is that, Diane, you are still associated in the public mind, as opposed to perhaps people who are attending hustings, with old Labour politics. Now, they think they know what that means. They're wondering what the old Labour, if you like, response to the ideas that David Cameron is coming up with, because we're beginning to see a little bit of what the big society might mean. I think it's an unformed, amorphous concept, but we're beginning to see that. They're wondering what the response to that is, rather than to look back, rather than looking backwards, and how, what case you make for that. Now, you're a big proponent of civil liberties, and obviously some of the things which the Theresa May has done since coming into power, you I think would support. But obviously, you'd also you wouldn't want to see things that are done by the state being left to charity, being left to the private sector, all the things that the government is currently doing. But we really need a response to that. We need to know what you would do. We need to know how you'd run these things better, and I'm not saying that.
Well, first of all, in response to what Theresa May has done, I made a point of getting up in Parliament to welcome her review of anti-terrorism legislation. I'm very clear on that. I'm one of the few, I'm the only leadership candidate that's done that. On the question of the big society, of course it's great in principle. And I tell you something, as a daughter of immigrants, when the immigrants came in the 50s and 60s, they couldn't rely on the state in the same way that native British people could do. And so they were forced to have a kind of version of the big society within their own communities. So I'm very familiar.
So you think it's an idea that's got potential?
No, let me just complete it. I'm very familiar and comfortable with the idea of communities helping themselves without the state there. But you can't be the MP for Hackney with so many very poor people and so very many marginalised people, and also such a complex society, and welcome the idea that somehow the state is going to divest itself of some of its responsibilities and the community, some amorphous community, is going to take over. That is a recipe for marginalised communities, inarticulate communities, to go to the wall. And I have to put this to you, Ros, and it may come as a shock. Not everybody, after a hard day's work, wants to go to a meeting of some collective and take decisions. They actually want the state to provide them with basic essentials.
I have to
and
go that's home and the look problem. After my child.
That's
I'm,
the problem.
I'm very aware of that.
That's the problem with the big society. Yeah. It relies on people who have the time and the inclination to go to endless meetings to sort things out.
Now, Diane, you've argued that, and I understand this, that the controversial decision you took to educate your son privately is a private matter. But can I just ask, is it realistic, as someone who's standing to go right into the spotlight of public life, to expect that they won't face kind of unending scrutiny about exactly this kind of thing?
No, I've never argued it's a private matter. Broadly speaking, over 7 or 8 years, people have asked me about it and I've answered them.
Right.
I mean, occasionally people have asked me about it and it's clear the conversation was going nowhere. But broadly, I mean, I've answered the question over and over again, and nor am I... You know, when I took the decision to send my son to City, I seriously thought I might be removed as an MP. So I'm not somebody that miscalculated the problems that would be caused to me by doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it... It is what it is. If it wasn't this, it would be something else, you know.
And also, just how would you square it, if we bring it back to policy, how do you square it with Labour's opposition to, you know, the Michael Gove school stuff, which is about more schools getting more independence like City and more parents having more choice?
That's no, the Gove stuff is... At best, you can say it's foolish. At worst, you can say it's malicious. So what the Gove stuff is really about is the withering away of local education authorities. Every school will be a little self-governing municipality and the LEA will wither away. The problem is, as I know, because I've worked on issues of equality in schools and Black Country Jubilee schools long before I had to take difficult decisions about my own son, is the only lever on things like special needs and equalities and recruiting teachers from all communities is your local education authority. And if Gove had his way, we would take education back to the 19th century.
Diane, did you back the Labour move into creating academies, specialist schools, attempts to raise standards in Hackney? Because one of the arguments you make is that Labour MPs like yourself can really fight for better education in places like Hackney. What was did you back those moves? Because they have improved education in Hackney, as you pointed out.
I certainly did back them.
But isn't Gove's stance very much?
The thing about the academies programme is that it was focused on underperforming schools. A lot of extra money went with it. That's why all the academies in Hackney have glittering new buildings. The idea that you can just dub institutions, academies, all institutions, academies, and somehow just the word is going to transform the schools, that's nonsense. I mean, Mossbourne is a great school because it was a greenfield site, it had a brilliant head, and I supported Mossbourne from the time it was a building site to today. But you misunderstand the government's academies programme if you think it's just about changing the names of schools.
Right, we're almost at the end now, but like we've done with the other candidates so far, and unfortunately for the others, what we'll do with them as well, is just ask you to place yourself, if you would, on a left-right spectrum. I've got here a little chart where Ed Bald has positioned himself somewhere to the left, and Andy Burnham has positioned himself, he insists, in the dead centre. Where would you plonk yourself?
I'm to the left of Ed Bald.
Left of Ed Bald,
particularly
not,
on immigration.
Not at the fringe.
because my views are too mainstream to be described as fringe.
On the shocking revelation that Diane Abbott is a touch to the left of Ed Bald, we'll draw things to a close for this week. My thanks to Ros Taylor, Julian Glover, and to Diane Abbott for coming into the pod. And thanks also to our producer, who was Phil Maynard. There's no podcast next week, but we will be back on Thursday the 12th of August, and then it will be Ed Miliband's turn in the pod. Thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.